Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and talk about on this day where the stock market rebounded and bank stocks went up. Nevertheless, there's still the possibility of a Greek default, and we'll look into how that will affect the big European and American banks and the European economy already in recession as a result of austerity measures. William K. Black, the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board and author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, joins us to analyze the ongoing inability of the Europeans to deal with the euro crisis. Then, if you thought the 99%, 1% divide was bad enough, how about the 99.000037% versus the 0.000063% divide? Joining us is Ari Berman, a contributing editor to The Nation and the author of an article at Tom Dispatch and The Huffington Post, The 0.000063% Election, How the Politics of the Super Rich Became American Politics. We will discuss how the super rich have taken over our politics in this election via the super PACs that now dominate campaigns. Then finally, we will look into the overwhelming vote today in the UN Security Council, the UN General Assembly, condemning the Syrian regime. James Galvin, a specialist on Syria at UCLA, joins us to assess whether the Assad family regime, with the help of Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela, can kill enough Syrians to hold on to power, or whether the growing opposition inside the country will be able to fight back and turn the tables. Joining us now is William K. Black, who is the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disasters of the 1980s. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007, and he's the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Welcome to Background Briefing, William K. Black.
Thank you.
And there's a kind of a paradox here, or a bit of a contradiction here, in as much as most of the news today, the stock market went up to its highest point of this year today, and bank stocks are up, including, I think, Bank of America up by 3.5%. And yet there's still this lingering notion that the Greece could default, and that the European banks will take a hit, and it'll echo back here. So, give us a sense of whether or not there's a mixed signal here.
Well, a series of the stories you've talked about are interconnected. What you're seeing in both Europe and the United States is that wealth is enormously concentrated in the financial sectors, and the financial sectors have dominant political power in Europe and the United States. And in both countries, they have severe problems in that they have tons of bad assets. And among the really bad assets the banks have are sovereign debt of places like Greece and Portugal and Spain and Ireland and such. And none of these countries has a sovereign currency anymore. And because they don't have a sovereign currency, they're at much, much greater risk of default.
So what do we make then, Bill Black, of the euro surging, which reversed an early decline after the reports that the Eurozone central banks had agreed to exchange Greek bonds they hold for new bonds as part of a deal to help Greece avoid falling off the precipice?
The strength of the dollar and the euro in terms of international exchange has almost nothing to do with this crisis. The issue is default, which is a different question than what the value of the euro should be compared to other currencies. The overall euro, there's no reason why it isn't going to pay off. In other words, if you have a euro and you go to a bank, you're going to get paid. So that's not the question. So what is going on, however, is there's a fundamental problem in the structure, two fundamental problems in the structure of Europe. One is with regard to the euro, in that they've created a transnational currency with nations that are in vastly different economic conditions. And there's no one in charge of Europe, and Europe is not a United States of Europe. In other words, when Greece gets in trouble, we don't say, that's a problem, and money is going to flow from the federal government to Greece, and we'll fix the problem. No, what happens is the Germans start screaming about how awful the Greeks are. And so you're actually seeing instead of ever closer union, which, as you know, is the rallying cry in particular of the French about the EU, the European Union, you're seeing ever greater disunity.
Well, my understanding is that a number of prominent politicians and in Germany and in business leaders have started openly talking about how Greece is awash with phantom pensions, and the rich don't pay their taxes, and they're absolutely fed up with it. And apparently, some of the meetings behind the scenes between the German representatives and the Greek representatives have gotten pretty nasty. What's your sense, Bill Black, of how much everybody's sort of shuffling the 900-pound gorilla in the living room around and denying its presence in terms of the real exposure of German and French banks?
Oh, enormously. That's the reason, after all, that the West German, in the old days, the German chancellor, Merkel, has lost 6 of the last 7 state elections, and has done so in large part because Germany has continued to do bailouts. Why has Germany continued to do bailouts, and why has Merkel, despite these political defeats, continued to do it? Well, because the bailouts, at least to this point, have the principal beneficiary has been German banks. And so she cares more about the German banks than losing particular state elections, because she fears that a financial crisis among German banks would lead to an even greater bailout, domestic bailout in this case, and sweep her party out of power for a decade or more.
Well, I heard Simon Johnson today speaking, and he's a former chief economist for the World Bank. And in contrast to the good news on Wall Street today with the stock market and bank stocks and GM stock, of course, GM had a record profit here in the United States, but of course, it's offset by record losses in Europe, which we may get into what's happening in Europe in contrast to the United States. So I'm still having trouble reconciling what seems to me to be a really dire reality in Europe that they still can't deal with, and all of this is sort of optimistic news today.
Well, Europe has decided to throw the periphery to the wolves, and in particular the southern periphery, and, you know, in European terms, mostly Catholic periphery. And you know that religion is only vaguely in the background. I can tell you as an American, when you go there, the openly racist explanation, and this comes from top financial leaders, you know, wearing nice suits and being CEOs of top financial institutions, is just staggering from an American perspective. Just the degree of hate, and it's expressed in American blacks, who they claim caused the entire global crisis. It's expressed as Turks, and then expressed ethnically as the whole southern tier, but in particular the Greeks and such. And, much of it comes from Germans or Germanic-speaking Swiss who have a bad history in all of this. And, you know, the head European Parliament, his first name is Jean-Claude, but the name after that is Juncker. And, you know, the Junkers in their famous role in Germany and such. So this is awakening lots of the darkest hates and the darkest fears in Europe. And Simon is absolutely correct. They have not fixed it in the least. And to fix it, they need both an economic fix and they need a political fix, and they're going absolutely the wrong direction in Europe. First, they let the thing twist slowly in the wind, which when you're dealing with a financial crisis is a terrible idea. And second, they've actually made austerity worse. And this should be a real caution to the United States, because the Eurozone has just gone back into recession because of this quest to balance the budget. So they're having their double-dip recession right now.
And do you think that that Obama and the Democrats can make that case? Because the Republicans want to do what the Europeans have done. They want austerity budgets. I mean, you know, Obama's budget was ridiculed by the Republicans because it didn't deal with the deficit. In fact, it had stimulus.
Right. But what you see is the administration not even attempting to defend it. The United States has, compared to Europe, been an area of strength in this recovery. Obviously, the stimulus was grossly inadequate compared to the loss of private sector demand from the Great Recession, but it has still prevented us from going back into an ever-deepening recession, and it's led to a modest recovery, whereas Europe has shot its, well, probably aimed to shoot Greece in the foot and shot itself in the foot instead.
So what's your sense then, William K. Black, of whether there's going to be another shoe to drop? As I mentioned, Simon Johnson seemed to think that the European banks are, and the Eurozone and the European Central Bank aren't dealing with the underlying problems, in particularly with Greece and with the southern tier, and that that also involves Ireland, but Portugal and Spain and Italy. And he also said that the U.S. banks, because of the banking lobby, are not prepared to recognize how it's going to impact them. They don't have any reserves on hand at the end of the day. I think because of this too big to fail notion, they're basically not acting responsibly.
Well, in terms of shoes yet to drop, it is going to be something like being in Imelda Marcos's closet during an earthquake. Just to talk about the biggest shoes to drop, and some of these are already in the process of dropping. First, every government that has adopted austerity has fallen in Europe as soon as it came up for election. So there's tremendous political instability. Second, unemployment in the periphery is now characteristically 20% or thereabouts. And for new, you know, 18-year-old to 22-year-old types, it's closer to 50%. So if you have two kids, one of them is likely to be unemployed, and emigration is becoming severe. If you're a college graduate in Ireland, the norm is to leave Ireland now, for example. So this is going to be the lost generation. It's having devastating effects on all of these nations. It's going to lead to increased hostility within the EU, political instability in most of the nations of the EU, and they're either going to have to go to something much more like a true United States of Europe, and the odds are very poor against that, or they're more likely to go to a much smaller, purer euro system. Basically, it doesn't appear now that they would really like the Greeks to be part of the euro, or for that matter, most anybody else in the periphery as well.
So they, but there's a difference between wanting something to happen and making it happen, right? They can't let Greece fall off the cliff at the same time they want to get rid of them. So what is the next move?
Well, the next move is, that's precisely the problem. All of the appropriate responses involve very substantial pain. And since they try to avoid pain, they are always looking for a silver bullet solution. And that means, of course, there aren't silver bullet solutions very often, so they don't do much of anything. What could be done, and the reason that the euro went up today is, as you said, the European Central Bank, the ECB, became more active in purchasing bonds. And that's the closest thing to a silver bullet solution there is. The ECB could act as a true European institution and say that we are going to use our ability to create money. You know, from the standpoint of the ECB, it is more like a sovereign currency, the euro, to fix the problems in Europe in the periphery. But that would take a really bold move, and as you probably recall, one of the senior officials in the European Central Bank, a prominent German banker, quit the ECB now about 5 months ago, demanding that it not take any action to provide relief to the periphery. And so there would be an intense German opposition to the ECB fulfilling a more transnational role.
Well, we have to also, I think, into this mix add the fact that Brent crude rose today, topping $120 a barrel, in part in response to the Iranians saying they're going to cut off oil to the their European customers preemptively because of the European Union's boycott, which is supposed to take place in July. So the Iranians are saying, okay, we're not going to allow you to wean yourself off our oil. We're going to force you to go cold turkey. That's rattling the markets as well. It would seem if you've got a recession, the last thing you want is a high price of gasoline.
Well, this is one of the major unstated stories in terms of politics and economics intersection in many places. So, for example, you had the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, claiming that Texas was an economic miracle and it was due to his brilliance. Well, all the oil patch states are doing better by far than they were doing because the price of energy has gone up. So Oklahoma looks better, Texas looks much better, even Louisiana looks better because of that. That's the only thing Putin has going for him,
right,
in Russia. And there are, of course, a number of other energy-rich nations in the world. If they're net exporters, they are big winners. But if you get a war, or even if you get a blockage of the Straits of Hormuz, and Iran is most assuredly getting ready to create at least a credible threat,
right,
of attacking supertankers in the Gulf of Hormuz, you would have an immediate dramatic effect.
Well, Will Black, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, but I thank you so much for joining us and giving some different nuance to the so-called good news on the market today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with William K. Black, the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and he was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007. He's the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the 0.000063% who are buying our elections through their super PACs.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ari Berman, a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. He has written extensively about American politics, foreign policy, and the intersection of money and politics. He's the author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. And he has an article at both The Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, the 0.000063% election, how the politics of the super rich became American politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ari Berman.
Thanks for having me again, Ian.
So one-upping the Occupy movement, the notion that they've brought up the divide between the 99% and the 1%, which seems to have become a part of the kind of political zeitgeist, if you will. Now you're telling us, Ari, that it's not 1%, it's 0.00063% that really are shaping our elections.
Well, as Stephen Colbert joked, Occupy Wall Street needs to change their signs because it is we are the 0.99999937%, in fact. And the way that I calculated these numbers is if you look at who's giving money to the super PACs, which are quickly overtaking the candidates as the most important entity in American politics, 196 donors have given nearly 80% of the money to super PACs by giving $100,000 or each. And so that's how you get 0.000063%.
So this, of course, is early days, right? I mean, these are dueling billionaires, mostly in the Republican camp. What's going to happen when they settle on a candidate, the Republicans? And Obama's already said that he's going the super PAC route as well. So is this just a warm-up, what we're seeing now?
Yeah, I mean, it is true. This is really just an early arms race that is likely going to escalate into an all-out war because we have the Republican primary, but the money has been spread among a bunch of different candidates. Romney had by far the most money. If you look at his super PAC, he raised $30 million last year. 98% of that money came from $25,000 donations or more, which I thought was pretty staggering. And 10 people gave Romney $1 million. Now, there's nothing to stop any donor from giving $100 million. There's nothing to stop a donor from giving $1 billion if they wanted to either Barack Obama, Mitt Romney, or anyone else. They could give it to a super PAC, at which point they probably would have to disclose it unless it was done through some shell corporation. Or even more disturbingly, they could give it to a 501c4 organization, which is supposed to exist for the purpose of social welfare, and then they don't even have to disclose the donation. So we could see hundreds of millions of dollars funneled into the 2012 election in secret donations.
And in your article, Ari Berman, you're suggesting here that what we've seen from Adelson, the casino billionaire in Las Vegas, who's given $5 million to Gingrich, and his wife gave another $5 million, and he said that he's being a bit churlish about how much more he's going to give to Gingrich, but he said if Romney becomes the presidential candidate, he'll give him money. And you're suggesting that somebody like him, who's hell-bent on preventing the Obama administration from standing in the way of an Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, could give $100 million for that matter.
He could. I mean, Adelson is a super wealthy individual. He is one of the 10 wealthiest individuals in America. He is obsessed with one issue, that is Israel. He doesn't want anything that will create peace between Israel or Palestine, and he doesn't want the U.S. to stop Israel from attacking Iran. And so he's willing to spend as much money as it takes to get someone in there who can replace the Obama administration and have a more hawkish government that will unilaterally support Israel. And so if that's his one issue, he's going to do whatever it takes. But there's other issues. I mean, who knows? If someone who runs an oil company wants to gut a regulation, I mean, they can give as much as they want. Not only on the presidential level, but also on the congressional level, where I think super PACs are going to have the most impact because they can really come in, flood a congressional campaign on the airwaves with negative ads and really swing a close election much more effectively than they can in a presidential election, which is effectively nationalized.
So you mentioned the 501c4, Ari Berman. That's an IRS nonprofit umbrella that's meant for civic leagues or organizations not organized for profit but operated exclusively for the promotion of social welfare. This has become corralled by super PACs and it become their favorite conduit because, one, they get anonymity, but, two, don't they get a 40% tax write-off?
They're tax-exempt social welfare organizations, and this is really a complete racket that is going on because these groups were not intended to function in this manner. And the 501c4s can't be as direct as super PACs can in terms of running ads. So the super PACs can run ads directly against candidates saying vote against Barack Obama. The 501c4s are limited more to issue ads, but they're de facto ads for and against candidates. And you have a situation now where, take for example, American Crossroads, which is the Karl Rove founded group that's probably the largest conservative outfit on the right in the 2012 election. They have a super PAC and they have a 501c4. And the 501c4, which is known as Crossroads GPS, has raised twice as much money as the other organization, all from secret donations. So that's, I think, even more disturbing phenomenon than the super PACs themselves.
And your article points out, Ari Berman, that the Washington Post found that 40% of the TV ads in the presidential race so far come from these tax-exempt social welfare groups. And clearly, they're designed for charity and philanthropy. And there's an incentive for rich people to give money for the right reason. But now there's an incentive for them to give money, arguably for the wrong reason.
Yeah, and this is really something that I think either the court, although this Supreme Court is unlikely to do so, or certainly the Federal Election Commission really needs to investigate, because this is a perversion of the law, and you could argue that it's even a perversion of the Citizens United decision itself. And they've very skillfully exploited a loophole to funnel even more money into the political system, and this time in absolute total secret.
So I was just talking to Senator Bernie Sanders a couple of days ago, and I mentioned to him that, you know, I get all this progressive mail solicitations, and it seems to be one of the great tragedies on the American left is that you've got all these wonderful young people who would be great political activists, but all the interest groups on the left ever do is ask them for money, which they don't have. And all that energy and talent is not being used. But that's another issue. But the long and the short of it is a lot of the stuff that's the mail I'm getting lately is people having fundraisers to overturn Citizens United. And I'm thinking, well, what's the money going towards? I mean, there's no strategy out there. There's no coherent national movement. Sanders has agreed that there's not a constitutional amendment is an awfully high bar and takes a long time, and that there has to be stuff done sooner. So what do you see on the radar in terms of a workable way to get to that goal of overturning Citizens United without having to spend years trying to get a constitutional amendment through?
Yeah, well, I agree with you that a constitutional amendment is probably very far off if it would ever happen. At the same time, legislation that could pass the Congress that would, for example, incentivize small donations based on the Fair Elections Now Act doesn't look likely to move anytime soon, especially with Republicans in control of the House. But honestly, even when Democrats were in control of Congress, they weren't moving this type of legislation. You have court challenges to Citizens United. Montana is challenging the law right now. It certainly doesn't seem like this Supreme Court, which gave us Citizens United, is going to challenge that anytime soon. But if you had a different Supreme Court, for example, if Obama's reelected, you have a different Supreme Court, you could see a change there. Now, would they wholly overturn Citizens United? I mean, I'm not sure about that, but they could certainly start chipping away at it, and then you could have the beginnings of a more comprehensive strategy. But I do think, Ian, unfortunately, we're going to have to probably go through this election. It's probably going to have to get worse before everyone is aware of the problem and enough people are willing to do something about it, because people have always known there was too much money in politics. But I do think the one good thing that has come out of the whole super PAC era is that finally, people have had something they can latch onto as an example of what's wrong with the problem. And you've had, for example, Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart really illustrate how perverse the system has become. And after all this money is spent, after all the negative TV ads, I do really think that the American people are going to be so fed up that they are going to demand bolder solutions, and that could become one of the next manifestations of the Occupy movement.
And, of course, the irony is, Ari Berman, that if you were able to overturn Citizens United and went back to the status quo ante, you wouldn't be in much better shape. I mean, it was pretty...
No, you wouldn't, and that's the problem. I mean, before you can get any sort of reform, you have to overturn Citizens United because it's such a barrier to any sort of progressive change. But it is true that the system as it was before was very imperfect to begin with. And so, really, overturning Citizens United just has to become the beginning of the discussion, because then there's all the other steps of what do you do. And as I said, I still think that some form of publicly financed elections is the best way to go. We're never going to get money completely out of the system, but we have to figure out some way to incentivize candidates to go the small donor route, because right now they have absolutely no incentive, particularly in the super PAC era, to seek out small donations at all.
Again, I'm speaking with Ari Berman, who's a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. So given now that on the Republican side, we've seen Gingrich's sugar daddy there with Adelson and his wife, and there's been a difficult to know who Romney's sugar daddies are, not that he himself, being a quarter billionaire, is not short of some spare change himself. But the race that's shaping up now in a couple of weeks in Michigan is interesting, and it's brought out the Santorum's sugar daddy, this rather strange fellow, Foster Freeze.
He offered his
I mean, it's amazing to think the Republicans are running on an issue of banning contraception. But he offered his insight into contraception, quoting Foster Freeze. This is Rick Santorum's sugar daddy. "This contraceptive thing, my gosh, it's such inexpensive. Back in my days, they used Bayer aspirin for contraception. The gals put it between their knees, and it wasn't that costly."
I mean, that is unbelievable. And I mean, that shows, I think that's the best two-word argument I've ever heard against super PACs, which is Foster Freeze himself, because you have a guy like that who, just by virtue of having a lot of money, is able to have an unbelievably disproportionate influence on the American election. And this guy is clearly crazy. I mean, he's out to lunch on basic public health principles, as is the candidate he's backing, Rick Santorum. And you have a strange situation where, in many ways, Rick Santorum versus Mitt Romney is a David versus Goliath battle, because Romney has so much more money, but Santorum is also being propped up by a billionaire as well. So it's sort of like you have one billionaire versus Santorum on Santorum's side, and then you have a bunch of billionaires and mega millionaires on the Romney side. But even insurgents nowadays have to have their own billionaire, which just shows you how warped the American political system really is right now.
Well, but isn't it extraordinary, though, Ari Berman, that Romney, who was all but a shoo-in in Michigan, the state in which he was born, in which his father was a governor and the head of an auto company, that Romney would be able to spoil his own chances by writing an op-ed in the Detroit Daily News on last Tuesday, criticizing Obama's bailout of General Motors and Chrysler. Here we have today General Motors posting record profits. My understanding of Detroit and of Michigan and broadly is that everybody thinks that, thank God, Obama rescued the auto business. The banks weren't about to do anything. They couldn't get any private equity to save themselves. It's just amazing to see that Santorum, who's just arrived in the state today, has done no campaigning, is actually ahead in pretty much all of the polls.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's hard for me to know whether the Romney's opposition to the auto bailout will hurt him among the Michigan Republicans, who tend to be more anti-bailout than the state in general. It's certainly hurting Romney in the general election, where the latest polling shows he's losing to Obama in Michigan by 18 points, which is just a massive blowout if those numbers hold. But I do think if you look beyond Michigan, Romney's money is really going to come in handy, because you have Super Tuesday shortly thereafter on March 6th, 10 contests vote that day. And that's really where the money advantage that Romney has, the ability to have a campaign organization in all those various states, to be able to be on the air in all those different states, especially if it becomes a nastier contest, could really overwhelm Santorum. So I do think momentarily Santorum could get the advantage of Romney, but I don't think in the long run that he's still going to be able to overtake him. And I think the super PAC money is a big reason why Romney has such a large advantage. It's true that money can't necessarily make you likable, and it doesn't necessarily win you an election, but it's also true that it gives you an enormous advantage. And in the super PAC era, money, I think, is more important than ever right now.
And that's proving to be the case in Arizona, where Romney's outspent Santorum massively, and there's something of a Mormon network there as well in that western state, which he's using to his advantage. Just in closing, though, Ari Berman, for the longest time, of course, a lot of progressives thought it was a great thing, that it would be a gift from the gods, if you will, that Obama got to run against either Gingrich or Santorum or Herman Cain or that Perry or that whole Bachman, that whole kind of clown show that preceded, that have been somewhat winnowed since then. But the more I look at Romney, I think maybe he'd be even an easier candidate for Obama and a better candidate to run against, to frame the disparity in wealth in this country and to have somebody that just simply can't get out of his own way.
Yeah, I mean, so I hear some Democrats actually saying that right now, because the campaign against Romney has already been written. It's that Romney is a 1% candidate. It's in his background. It's in his policy positions. It's in pretty much everything about him that Romney is really an unabashed supporter of Wall Street and the 1%, or as we've mentioned in this article, the 0.0001%. With Santorum, it's a different kind of campaign. It's more about Santorum's extreme views on social issues. It's more about his views on women and gay rights and things like that. And it's less about his views on economic policy, which aren't that different from Romney's. It's just that we don't know that much about him, and they haven't played a big role in his campaign. I still think the Obama administration would much rather run against Santorum than Romney. You take $200 million off the table if Romney is not the nominee. You take a whole organization that's been preparing for 4 years to run in a general election. So I think the White House would still much rather run against Santorum, but it is true that Romney is looking like a weaker candidate every single day.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Ari Berman.
Thanks, Ian. Appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Ari Berman, who is a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. He's written extensively about American politics, foreign policy, and the intersection of money and politics. He's the author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics, and has an article at The Huffington Post and at Tom Dispatch, The 0.0000063% Election, How the Politics of the Super Rich Became American Politics. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment talking about the UN General Assembly vote condemning Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his brand-new book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And today the United Nations General Assembly voted in favor of a resolution condemning human rights violations in Syria. It was an Arab League-backed initiative mirrored on the failed UN Security Council resolution that was vetoed by Russia and China. The vote was fairly overwhelming, 137 votes in favor of condemning the Assad regime, with Russia only 12 voting against. That is Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela supporting the Syrian regime. The General Assembly, there's no force of law here, of course. What do you think is the significance of this vote?
Well, it's a purely symbolic vote, of course. There is the possibility, a very outside possibility, that has been raised but will probably not happen, of something called the Uniting for Peace resolution, which would have a binding, or would actually have teeth to it. But this does not have teeth to it. But what it does is it just ups even more the sort of pressure on the Assad regime. Undoubtedly, the Assad regime is not going to respond directly to this. They are not going to cease their war against the opposition at this point. But it's very, very likely that this is just another chink in the armor of the Assad regime.
Well, apparently, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is personally outraged. He's been, I take it, working behind the scenes, and he said, quoting him, "We see neighborhoods shelled indiscriminately, hospitals used as torture centers, children as young as 10 years old killed and abused. We see almost certain crimes against humanity." Does he carry weight? Presumably he does.
Well, as Stalin once said about the Pope, how many divisions does he have? They're not going to give in. The Syrian regime is not going to give in. The Syrian regime at this point looks around. They have, according to recent polls, they do have the support of a majority of the population of Syria. 55% want Bashar al-Assad to stay, 45% in polls that were done in a way that you can filter out the self-censorship here. What this means, though, is very interesting. It's not really support for the regime. It's what the United Nations Development Program calls the legitimacy of blackmail, pretty much the legitimacy by blackmail. What that means, of course, is that the regime is saying, if we go, all hell's going to break loose. Syria will fragment. There'll be sectarian war. Christians will be massacred. Alawites will be massacred. So we need to stay on. And undoubtedly, this has a great deal of resonance with the Syrian population. So the Syrian regime has been able to get away with what it's doing.
Well, but the other side of that, surely, James Galvin, is the Syrian regime, because it refused to even acknowledge legitimate peaceful protest and started slaughtering its own people, has created this civil war. I saw a piece on CNN where the Free Syrian Army, or some of the rebels, for want of a better description, captured one of the assassins who was recruited from, he was a prison guard, recruited by the regime, paid, I think, $200 or something, given a sniper rifle. He's killed about 50 people himself, he admitted to. This is their MO, surely. They want to kill as many people as they can to stop people protesting, but they won't give them any other means of political expression.
Yes, and what's going on is sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. At the very beginning of the protest, Bashar al-Assad said, look, these are violent protesters, and they're sectarian protesters. They're Sunni Muslims out to get Alawis, and this is what the whole thing is all about. And by continuing the level of violence, by continuing the crackdown, by actually escalating the level of violence, Bashar al-Assad actually made it into, number one, violent, and number two, sectarian. So it was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So what is likely to happen then? The Security Council vote was quite acrimonious. UN Representative Susan Rice was really furious with the Russians and the Chinese. She just called their attitude disgusting. We know that Russia is selling arms to the Assad regime, and private Russian individuals who are probably part of the KGB's crony capitalism operation that runs, you know, KGB Incorporated that runs Russia. They've invested $20 billion into Syria. They're hardly objective. The Chinese, I think, are feeling the heat from a lot of Arab countries. They've The Chinese have been engaged in a lot of efforts to create good relations with Saudi Arabia because of China's tremendous hunger for oil. And apparently they're getting an earful from the Arab countries. What do you expect from the their vice foreign minister being sent over there on Friday to meet with Assad?
Well, I don't expect anything to happen from the standpoint. The regime is constructed in such a way that it has to fight to the death. It's that simple. The regime, there's not going to be a Tunisia-Egypt option available to the regime or available to the opposition, actually, whereby part of the regime, as happened in Tunisia and Egypt, turned on the other part of the regime. The army turned on the executive branch involved. That's not going to happen. In Libya and in Yemen, you had a fragmentation of both of those regimes. That's not going to happen in Syria because the Syrian, those involved in this regime understand that they will all have to hang together or they'll all hang separately. So the only two possible scenarios, barring outside intervention, which looks very unlikely at this point, is that the regime will crush the opposition or the opposition will win. There's no other scenarios out there. Assad is attempting to defang the opposition by calling for a national dialogue. There's going to be a vote on constitutional amendments on the 26th of February. The opposition has already said this is nonsense. Assad's writing this document, and it's going to benefit him. And there's only minor changes around the edges that this new constitution is going to have. So they're not interested in either. The Syrian National Council is not interested in a national dialogue, although internal opposition intellectuals, etc., are. So for the most part, it's not going to resolve itself nicely. The level of violence is getting higher on the government side. The level of violence is also getting higher and with the Free Syrian Army. And there are rumors that jihadists, people like al-Qaeda, are moving into Lebanon and Syria with the idea of, well, maybe what we can do is contribute to this destabilization of the Assad regime. They view Assad, of course, as being a member of a heterodox sect, not being a real Muslim.
Well, I think there's good evidence, isn't there? And apparently the CIA has acknowledged as much that al-Qaeda was involved in the bombings in Aleppo. And the head of al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, recently made a statement urging the jihadis to join in the fight in Syria, obviously incredibly opportunistically, saying that we can't let the Westerners defend Arabs. We have to defend Arabs ourselves.
Right. This has not been a good year for Al Qaeda at all. I mean, the Bin Laden thing is one thing, but the so-called Arab Spring, the uprisings that have taken place, have demonstrated that there are other options available to people throughout the region other than the sort of jihadi option that al-Qaeda represents. But al-Qaeda represents something else as well, and that's really important for your listeners to understand. It's a transnational organization. It's even too mild to put it in terms of transnational. They don't believe in nations. They don't believe in nation states. They want to abolish what they consider to be a Western imposition in the Middle East. Each one of these uprisings that is taking place, the Syrian uprising as well, is a national uprising. They want to remove the regime of their individual countries. They have feelings for other places. There's, of course, a great deal of sentiment throughout the Arab world for what's going on in Syria. They also borrow tactics and symbols from previous demonstrations. But for the most part, this is a demonstration of the state system at work within the Arab world. So al-Qaeda is it's the odd man out. They can work around the edges of this thing. They can contribute to violence. But what they're not able to contribute to at all is the ideological message that's coming out of the opposition.
So James Gelvin, again, professor of history at UCLA, his research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria. The opposition is being organized. The Turks have provided some kind of a safe haven for the Free Syrian Army. It's difficult to know exactly where, whether I don't think they're allowed to carry arms in Syria, inside of Turkey. But clearly they're getting arms from somewhere. In the Anbar province of Iraq, the Sunni area of Iraq that borders on Syria, apparently there's a lot of sympathy for the Free Syrian Army from the rebellion. And I imagine the same is true on the Jordanian border. On the Lebanese border, it's a little more complicated because of the presence of Hezbollah being allied with Iran, who in turn are allied with the Assads. What's the likelihood of these neighbors getting involved? And the more I imagine the Sunni Iraqis get involved, the more that brings back the possibility of an Iraq fissures within Iraq itself.
Well, none of them will get involved officially. The furthest that has gone so far is that the Turks have, as you said, provided safe haven for the Free Syrian Army and also for armies of refugees that have crossed over the border. Same thing with the Lebanese, for example. But as far as official intervention, that is not going to happen. And there's a whole variety of reasons why, starting off with a certain ambivalence on the part of the leadership of the neighbors, and going all the way through the military options not being very good at all either. You have to understand that a fragmented Syria, which might be the end, which might be the end point of what happens with the if the opposition wins, a fragmented Syria is not good for Lebanon. A fragmented Syria is not good for Turkey and for Iraq, which also have 10% of Syria's population is Kurdish. Iraq and Turkey, of course, have sizable Kurdish populations. In terms of Lebanon, it's a very bad precedent that would take place. Plus, the fact is, of course, that it's possible that Hezbollah, not being the official Lebanese government, but Hezbollah, would actually create trouble with a some sort of Muslim Brotherhood type operation taking root in Syria. So, none of the governments involved want anything to. Want to get involved directly. The Israelis are also extremely ambivalent about the Assad regime, as we are. We've been calling for Assad to step down, but on the other hand, it took us a long, long time to get to that place. And we got to that place only after repeated massacres of the Syrian population and only after there really was no other option available to us. The national dialogue that we called for at first was not working. The idea of Assad himself to, as Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama put it, for him to either lead the reform or get out of the way, that obviously was a non-starter. So in the very end, what we did was we did what we did at the very end in Egypt, what we did at the very end in Yemen, et cetera, which is eventually side with the opposition.
So, James Gilvin, you mentioned earlier that polls indicate, and I wonder how one does the polls in Syria or gets accurate ones, but that aside, you're saying that over 50% of the population support the government of Assad, not because they like the Assad regime, but because they're afraid of a civil war and pogroms that would follow, and that it's a race in time, in effect, between how long the Syrian Assad regime can murder its own people and murder them into submission vis-a-vis how much the Free Syrian Army can find defectors from the military, which apparently they are doing on a daily basis. So give us a sense of those correlation of forces there and give us your best bet on how this is going to pan out.
Well, as I said, eventually what's going to happen is one side is going to destroy the other side. Either the government's going to destroy the opposition or the opposition is going to destroy the government. It's not a Libya situation. It's not a situation in which, for example, there is a freed territory, as there was in Benghazi in the eastern part of Libya, which allowed for a base for the rebels. One thing that's very similar with the Libya situation is that those that are defecting either with small arms or with no weapons at all. So you don't really have a balance of forces here. What you have is the Free Syrian Army has been capable of targeting government officials, security officials. A general was killed the other day. So they can do assassinations, they can do hit-and-run attacks on military units and on, more importantly, on who they perceive to be the real enemy, which is the security services. For the most part, they are totally outgunned, totally outmatched, and particularly when you consider what the tactics of the Syrian military is right now. They don't necessarily have to go into the cities. They can stay outside of the cities and just shell them from the outside. They've done that. Then enter the city with tanks to clean up any pockets of resistance that might still be there. So that's the sort of thing that the sort of tactics that they've employed because they can, and because there is no real opposition that's capable of stopping the Syrian military. So in terms of the balance of forces, it's not really there.
So the Free Syrian Army, my understanding is that they're borrowing some of the tactics that have been very effectively used in Iraq against the U.S. and in Afghanistan against NATO. They're building IEDs quite in substantial numbers.
Yes, I mean, that's my understanding as well. I mean, but the question, of course, is that they're not fighting an outside occupier at this point. They're not swimming like the fish in the sea, as Mao put it. Mm-hmm. What they are is they're fighting a government that still enjoys a great deal of support within the territory that government purportedly controls. So it's a very, very different situation. The other thing is that there was a debate over the summer about whether or not the resistance should turn violent. And the side that said, no, let's keep it nonviolent, was saying, look, what we have is we have a certain sympathy that we're creating throughout the world with the nonviolent tactics. What we're doing is we're creating a great deal more sympathy within Syria itself. Our ranks are building with this stuff. And we also have a moral force here that will, draw more and more people in. Now that debate is completely over, of course. Violent tactics are alongside the daily demonstrations that the population is doing. So the opposition has lost a great deal of that moral force that was there, for example, in Tunisia and Egypt with their, it's been overplayed, but they were for the most part peaceful demonstrations. So the question then is, over time, what's going to happen in terms of popular support for the opposition as IEDs are used and as various other tactics are used, which are fairly indiscriminate? And the answer might lie in the fact that in that same poll, which showed support for the government. By the way, the poll was done electronically on Facebook, whereby it could be hidden. The addresses of the people who were being polled. I'm not that familiar with the electronics of it, but I was assured that it was one of those things that the government could not find out who was involved in it. But according to that poll, the population blames the violence on the opposition by an overwhelming amount. So this doesn't bode well for popular support for the opposition in Syria.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I mean, speaking with James Galvin, who's a professor of Middle East of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, and he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and the Mass Politics of Syria at the Close of Empire and the Modern Middle East, A History. And his brand new book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.